as we get into this budgetary situation we're in, you always got to look at some of the strategic options we're looking at. Is it really a cost-effective option, or are we looking at a fool's errand? Because in the national security world, often it's not so much a discussion between is a strategic concept or an operational ideal, is it good or bad, but is it adequate to our needs or is it dangerous to us? It's a very different concept. And our guest for the full hour, to kind of touch on one aspect of that thought, really focusing on the concept of offshore balancing, specifically in the Indian Ocean. For those that haven't had a chance yet, you can find a link both at the show page at Blog Talk Radio, but also over at our home blogs and the blog over at the U.S. Naval Institute. Their latest article in the periodical Asian Security, An Ocean Too Far, Offshore Balancing in the Indian Ocean. And this article was written by Jim Holmes and Toshi Yoshihara. They are both associate professors of strategy over at the U.S. Naval War College. Jim and Toshi, welcome back to MidRats.
Hey, thanks for the invitation.
Thanks for having us.
Great. Hey, just to kind of lead off, the when you look at offshore balancing, it's something that people have touched on articles now and then, and people can get the details of the article if they haven't read it already. But what brought, Jim, you and Toshi to the subject of offshore balancing, specifically looking at the Indian Ocean?
Well, last year we got involved with an Indian Ocean strategy project for the Department of Defense. We were actually asked not to comment on the project at all, but we were on a panel in San Diego a couple of weeks with the organizers of that project, and they told everybody about it. So I guess we can as well. The United States has not published an Indian Ocean strategy in recent memory, if ever, and there's been a lot of feeling that it's time to start to, you know, with the maritime strategy shifting our attention to maritime Asia, South Asia, as well as East Asia. It's just time to start to get smart on them. So the organizers at the War College commissioned a group of people to write papers on various subjects. We ended up doing two. We did both this one, a predecessor of this particular article, and we also wrote an article that examined what Japan might be doing in the Indian Ocean, which we concluded that they wouldn't be doing very much, simply because of the limitations of their force and budgets and whatnot. But in any event, we came to it pretty much from the outside. We went in with no strong feelings one way or the other about what we thought about offshore balancing. But the more we read about it, the more we got troubled by it, because it seemed like to us like various CNOs, in particular Admiral Roughhead, that we're really drinking the Kool-Aid on offshore balancing without really understanding what it means in practice. So we, at that point, the paper started taking on a little more ominous overtones and became, I guess, more of a cautionary thing than anything. Toshi, you want to add to that? What did I forget?
Yeah. If I could add a little bit more context to this, is that as the project started to move along, it actually coincided with a series of speeches that were made by the former CNO, Admiral Roughhead, about this notion of an offshore option. And what was very interesting about that episode was that the offshore balancers in the international relations theory community began to sort of tout those speeches as evidence that, in fact, senior leaders in the U.S. military was beginning to sort of accept this notion that the United States had to become an offshore balancer. And I think as we read the speech and as we studied the theory of offshore balancer, we began to realize that there was, in fact, a substantial analytical divergence between what the admiral was saying and what the offshore balancers were trying to say. And so what we tried to do was essentially to set the record straight, to make sure that people didn't confuse the admiral's notion of an offshore option was not, in fact, the same as offshore balancing.
Well, let's go back. We have to go back a couple of steps here for me. I'm a slow guy. We're talking grand strategy. We're talking offshore balancing. What in the world is it, and what should our concerns be if somebody was in favor of it and somebody's as opposed to it?
Well, it's basically, just to make it very simple, it's basically the notion that the United States should pull withdraw from the Eurasian mainland in particular, and not get involved in costly ground commitments in Eurasia. So for obvious reasons, after a decade of involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan and places like that, this is a rather appealing notion. One of the key points that the proponents of offshore balancing will make is that it's a cost-saving strategy for the United States. The United States can spare itself the costs of maintaining expensive bases and deploying troops and all of that, and all of the things that we're familiar with. And essentially, what the offshore balancers are predicting, these are members of the realist school of international relations. They contend that if the United States pulls out of Eurasia, stops helping balance against these aspiring great powers like China or potentially India or whoever the next big power might be, that they predict that the powers that are actually in Eurasia, the neighbors or what have you, will actually start balancing themselves so that the United States will not need to. So essentially, the United States will pull out of Eurasia. And it will go back only if there's the rise of a hegemonic power, a great power that can dominate all of Eurasia. Preventing that from happening has been a standard tenet of U.S. Foreign policy, at least since the days of Teddy Roosevelt, who worried a lot about that. So the U.S. pulls out, it acts as the balancer of last resort, spares itself a lot of costs, and people like Robert Pape at the University of Chicago predict that the United States will also depress the resentments that go towards the United States by having a large and visible presence in Eurasia. So pull out, save yourself the costs, and go back only as a last resort. These proponents of offshore balancing set a very high standard for when to go back. And in fact, Christopher Lane down at Texas A&M, who occupies a lot of our attention in this particular article, because he gives specifics about how he would implement this vision, he suggests that the United States could have remained out of World War II. So that gives you an idea of just how high the threshold for some of these people is.
Right, and I would also add that we should understand offshore balancing as a grand strategy, as an alternative to other alternatives. In the aftermath of the Cold War, there was a real sort of powerful debate within the international relations theory community about what sort of grand strategies the United States could opt to choose. And offshore balancing is really sort of one grand strategy of four large categories of grand strategies. And let me just sort of list the other three so that we get a sense of sort of where offshore balancing is situated amongst the various choices that the United States has. The first one on one extreme is a strategy of preponderance, which is that the United States would essentially pursue a strategy of hegemony in which the United States would be the top dog in the international system and would essentially seek to dominate the world by maintaining the most powerful military in the world, by essentially being strong everywhere, having the capacity to intervene in all kinds of crises and conflicts and all parts of the world. Now, that's sort of an oversimplification, but that's sort of one bucket of a grand strategy that the United States could pursue. The less intrusive version is what some IR theorists called a selective engagement, and that is where the United States would essentially focus on places where it has always been strong, and that would be Western Europe and Northeast Asia, would continue to develop those alliances, and also to ensure that those allies could help the United States in policing the international system. And I think sort of the lesser intrusive version of that grand strategy would be offshore balancing, which is, as Jim said, we would pull back and we would expect our allies and friends to do most of the heavy lifting. But then there's another category, and this one is essentially a strategy of isolationism, in which the United States would bring everyone home and would not meddle and would not become entangled and engaged in crises or conflicts abroad. Now, sometimes it's hard to tell the distinction between offshore balancing and isolationism, but I would simply say that I think those who would argue that the United States should pursue isolationism would in fact cut off all ties with its current allies and friends. I think this is a good way of thinking about sort of U.S. grand strategy as having a spectrum of options where I think offshore balancing is not entirely isolationist, but certainly much less engaged than we are today.
Yeah, there's a. This is actually a just on this notion of isolationism. Obviously, this comes up a lot, and these offshore balancing scholars are very sensitive to it because, as you know, isolationism has been sort of a dirty word, at least since 1941 when the Japanese attacked and did away with the isolationist impulse for a time. But one of my favorite historians down at the University of Pennsylvania, Walter McDougall, spends a lot of time discussing this in his book from, I believe, 1997, Promised Land, Crusader State. He basically says, look, the United States was never really isolationist in any strict sense. The United States it always did business overseas. It always kept up diplomatic relations overseas, and so on and so forth. He prefers to call it unilateralism. The notion that the United States watches its own interests, avoids military and political entanglements overseas, and so forth. And that's a critical part of this debate over offshore balancing. And these people will go to great lengths. They will always say that we're not isolationists, and this is actually true in a strict sense, because they don't want to sever all ties with the outside world. They simply think that we should bring home our forward deployments and essentially balance from North America if possible.
Toshi, let me roll this one your way to start with the budget crunching that we're starting to see talked a little more seriously in the last couple of cycles of the defense budget, kind of paralleling what Europe has experienced in the previous decade. There's been a critique that instead of the ideal situation where a nation looks at what its strategic requirements are and then buys, trains, and equips and supports a military in order to be able to meet those requirements, that we're really looking at a situation where people want the defense budget to be at a certain level, and they're searching for a large strategy that will justify and enable that other goal they have, kind of flipping what you would want the ideal on the head. It seems that offshore balancing and isolationism, and I agree with you that the isolationism has a taint to it that people would run to. So I guess offshore balancing, do you see offshore balancing being used as a strategic justification for people whose perhaps greater goal is to diminish the size of the U.S. military capability?
Well, certainly for those who have been advocating offshore balancing, and they've been doing this for, I would say, almost two decades or even more than two decades, I think that for those who have been pushing this particular strategy, saw this, the financial crisis and then the kind of deep budget cuts that we're likely to experience as an opportunity for them to basically peddle this idea back out again, because it clearly is having resonance with both the American public but also some U.S. strategic elites as well. And I think that, you know, there is a very sort of a contentious debate right now as to whether we're essentially pursuing a budget-driven strategy rather than a strategy that drives the budget. And so I think, you know, certainly the notion that we can reduce costs by withdrawing from forward presence is something that is highly appealing, and I think that is why offshore balances have sort of reemerged back into the scene and sort of pushing this idea. And again, that's why it really coincided with Admiral Ruffett's speech that talked about the offshore option, although I think at some point we can sort of talk a little bit about why offshore option is not the same as offshore balancing.
Yeah, if I could just chime in, just one figure that we cite in the article that I found this to be really eye-popping when I stumbled across. I can't remember if Toshi came up with it or I did, but one of us stumbled across this Professor Lane, who I mentioned before. He cites a study conducted in the early 1990s, 1993, I think, in which essentially concluded that the United States spends half of the defense budget on what the authors of the study called imperial security responsibilities, meaning maintaining bases and forward deployments and whatnot. And so this study essentially contended that by offshore balancing, the United States can cut its defense budget by half. So that gives you. So as far as letting budgets drive strategy, I'm not sure if that's exactly what's happening. There's sort of a chicken or egg dynamic there, but you certainly get a sense of the magnitude of the cuts that offshore balancers may be proposing. Admiral Wiley, who's a former resident of Newport, wrote one of the gems of strategic theory back in the 1960s called simply Military Strategy. At one point, he points out that Congress and policymakers, when they decide on budgets, they're actually making strategic decisions whether they realize it or not. That's always been one of the passages from that book that has really stayed with me, especially when we talk about things like offshore balancing.
Right, and one of the key arguments that we make in the article is that, in fact, when you look at what would be required for us to actually balance effectively from an offshore position is actually not cost-effective at all. In fact, one could argue that the requirements that we set forth in terms of what it would take to become an offshore balancer is, in fact, quite costly. So I think this notion that you can do grand strategy on the cheap, I think, is really a very, very difficult proposition.
Well, you started out in the work that we're talking about, the ocean too far, talking a little bit about Kaplan's book, Monsoon, and the importance he places on the Indian Ocean. Can you discuss how you chose the Indian Ocean as your focus of why offshore balancing may be an ocean too far?
Sure. I mean, we chose the Indian Ocean as the subject for the article simply because this was an outgrowth of the Indian Ocean Strategy Project, and that was what they asked us to look at: was offshore balancing, is it viable in the Indian Ocean? And we conclude that basically for the operational reasons that Toshi just hinted at, we don't think so. Now, I'm glad you asked the question though, because in a sense, this is new ground for offshore balancing. In previous decades, and I mean even as back to a century ago, offshore balancing was a concept mostly confined to Western Europe and to East Asia, seas that are relatively, if you look at the map, these seas are relatively unobstructed and direct for the United States to project power onto. But at the same time, if you look at the Indian Ocean map, it requires a very long circuitous voyage to get there. You need bases. You need bases to sustain your presence there, and so on and so forth. So we found that as we did the article, we started off talking purely about the Indian Ocean, but we found that we ended up attacking the notion of offshore balancing even in East Asia and Western Europe, simply because of the various access denial measures that powers like China are developing. And so on and so forth. So we ended up launching a more general critique of offshore balancing rather than just confining it to the Indian Ocean. So sometimes a piece takes on a life of its own, and that was the case here.
Right, and I think part of our critique of the offshore balancers is that they sort of have a very old-fashioned view about the world in terms of the geopolitical structure of the international system. You know, when they talk about offshore balancing, they're talking about our ability to essentially do just-in-time balancing, essentially come to the scene to rescue a severe imbalance of power at the two ends of the Eurasian landmass, which is Western Europe and Northeast Asia. But I think if you look at the changing geostrategic environment, where the center of gravity has in fact shifted southwards to the so-called Indo-Pacific region, I think that the basic assumptions that have been underwriting the arguments by the offshore balancers have really changed. And this notion of the Indo-Pacific has, in fact, become increasingly accepted lexicon even in Washington. And this notion is that both China and India have turned seaward. This is really an unprecedented phenomenon in modern history, where two great land powers have turned to the seas at virtually the same time. And that, as they look to the seas, the types of drivers that are pushing them into the sea are very similar. They are both growing economies in which both need overseas energy resources and commercial goods in order to fuel that economy. And that means that their attentions will be driven increasingly towards the same bodies of water to their south, and that is the Persian Gulf, the Indian Ocean, and the South China Sea. those are the kinds of places that both powers are likely to become much more active, both in terms of their foreign policy, but also in terms of their naval activism. And as long as they continue to view each other with distrust, as long as they continue to have proprietary views about their own maritime backyards, we cannot exclude the possibility that the two powers might be headed towards a collision course down the road. As their navies grow, as their power projection capabilities grow, the potential for encounters at sea and in the commons is going to increase between these two powers. And again, because of the unprecedented nature of these turns to the sea, we argue essentially that really where great power conflicts are more likely to happen now and into the future is going to occur in the Indo-Pacific region rather than in the Atlantic or in the northern parts of the Western Pacific, which, I mean, if you think about it, the Atlantic has already sort of emerged into a zone of peace. And that explains why the maritime strategy that was issued in 2007 essentially said that we would retain credible combat power in the Indo-Pacific region, because we have shifted the two ocean navy construct from an Atlantic and Pacific fleet into something that would be, you know, I mean, I would call it an Asianized navy that would see our forces concentrate in the Indo-Pacific region. And so if we accept the premise that both China and India are turning seawards and that these are not ephemeral phenomena, but that will continue, and that we too will have to focus our attention in the Indo-Pacific, and I think that should be the basis of thinking about offshore balancing. And again, we argue that because of the rise of anti-access area denial technology on the rimlands, it means that it's going to make it even more difficult for us to reach the Indo-Pacific, and therefore, you know, it really requires us to think about the costs and the requirements for building the power projection capabilities to get into the Indo-Pacific region in times of crisis and conflict, particularly system-changing conflicts between great powers.
Jim, Toshi's comment is a perfect setup for my next question. I'm a big fan that if you want to look forward, you have to take a deep breath and you need to look back. And offshore balancing, does it really have any type of historical reference where it's a success? And along those lines, especially the Chinese, are studying hard our own work and our own experts, and in many ways we neglect. And of course, I'm talking about our friend Alfred Thayer Mahan. What does his writing and his scholarship inform the discussion about offshore balancing and if it's really a good concept for us?
I think there are two questions embedded in there, so let me take the first one really quick because you passed by it. So, I hope we don't come off in the article as being too caustic about offshore balancing. This is a tradition that has a long pedigree in American foreign policy. And in fact, I think you can look all the way back to the founders, whether it's President Jefferson and his first inaugural when he warns against entanglement in foreign wars and foreign politics, or even back to George Washington and his great rule of conduct in the famous farewell address of 1796, which essentially said the United States should concentrate on building itself into a strong nation, spreading westward across the continent, doing all the things that the U.S. did in the 19th century. And that it would be dangerous, it would sow faction, it would waste U.S. resources, it would have all sorts of ill effects if the United States started getting involved in European politics. So in a very real sense, George Washington and Jefferson are forefathers of this notion of offshore balancing. So if you want to look back to look ahead, that's not a bad place to start. With regard to Mahan, he does come up in the writings of the offshore balancers from time to time, largely just you don't get a lot of detail out of these folks. So they basically said, look, if we're going to be an offshore balancer, that's a naval and air concept, and Mahan is the face that they put on this this notion of balancing from the sea. Now, I think we spend a fair amount of time with Mahan and with other naval writers in this article, like Admiral Bradley Fisk, who writes rather eloquently about bases and what bases do for naval forces. And this seems to be something to me, I mean, that's one of the pillars of Sea Power for Mahan is overseas bases to support the operations of merchant fleets and of course, naval fleets. This seems to escape the offshore balancing scholars because they seem to have an exaggerated view of exactly how independent of bases fleets really are. We spend a lot of time in this article essentially pointing out that naval fleets are not completely independent of bases at all. We talk about even a nuclear powered ship, the carrier may be able to steam for years and years, but the air wing certainly can't. So even a carrier has to refuel underway every few days, as you know, being a seafarer yourself. So in any event, it's a pretty superficial inquiry into Mahan. He's basically just a face that they put on offshore balancing, in my view. Toshi, what did I forget?
Well, I think if you want to sort of turn this theoretical issue onto China, is that again, I think it reinforces the notion that if the Chinese do indeed look to the Indian Ocean as future stepping stones in which they can secure their sea lines of communications, then whether it's bases or places, they will need some sort of foothold along the Indian Ocean littoral in order for them to feel that they have energy security rather than this persistent sense of energy insecurity that I think sort of dominates or if not preoccupies the thinking of many Chinese strategic thinking. And so again, if you think about the role of bases in enabling sea powers to project power to do a variety of things, whether it's to project power ashore against an adversary or to simply to protect their own seaborne commerce, it, I think, reinforces our argument that the Indo-Pacific region is going to be a theater for great power interactions at the very least, if not great power competition and rivalry. And so I think, again, this makes this new theater, I think, the basis for thinking about where offshore balancing would take place. And if you read the Chinese and their writings about Mahan, it would suggest that they buy this logic and that as their capabilities increase, that we will find them in the Indian Ocean more frequently and with greater persistence and with greater capabilities.
Yeah, I mean, Mahan, it's just one more reference back to Mahan. Mahan, if you read that first, in particular that first 90 pages or so of the influence of sea power upon history, he worries a lot about American national culture. He worried that in the 19th century, in particular, the United States was so fixated on coastal defenses and commerce raiding and whatnot. He worried that the United States over time would not remain a maritime nation, simply because we had other things on our minds, and particularly as the country spread to the West Coast, and so much of the country is not looking seaward at all. Mahan worried that the United States might actually give up; it would either prove unable to go out and get bases overseas, or that it might not be able to sustain those. He has a famous quotation about that. He predicted, or he at least fretted, that the United States would have fleets that would be like land birds, unable to fly very far from American shores, simply because the American people and their leaders might not see fit to expend the resources necessary to keep those forward outposts.
Well, on one hand, we have the realistic school, the realistic school, I guess, of diplomacy, which seems to be a Hobbesian view of the world that everybody's out for themselves. There's no such thing as true cooperation between states. And that this policy, this offshore balancing, makes sense in the context of a world that is just bloody tooth and nail. But there, the other strategies, the cooperative strategy, would seem to imply that there's a whole different view of diplomacy out there, in which cooperation between states can be effective and can make for smooth operation of the world's supply chains, if you will, including that to China. There's no reason for everybody to get up in arms about China, to, you know, buying oil. It should be readily available if they want to pay the right price for it. Is there something I'm missing in the way this works that other than the potential cost savings for offshore balancing that seems to be driving some of these issues?
Well, I think there are actually a couple of things even within the realist argument that I find sort of problematic, and I want to talk a little bit about that before I talk about the sort of the Chinese view. The realist argument is that if we pull back our forces, the sort of the vacuum that we leave behind will be filled by the local players, and that they would essentially help themselves by rearming and by getting stronger in order to balance against the rising hegemon. And so in many ways, the offshore balancing argument is a critique of our relationship with our smaller, weaker allies, our European allies and our Japanese ally. And the critique is this: as long as we are forward deployed, as long as we are forward based on their territory, and as long as we are filling the power vacuum, then they have very little incentive to help themselves, to build up the military capabilities to defend themselves, that we create sort of a system of dependency amongst our allies. And so part of the solution to this is to withdraw so that our allies would essentially fill the vacuum on their own. They would then take up their own responsibility that should be theirs anyway. That's part of the realist logic. But I would also say that there's another possibility, which is that, some of these powers may actually seek to accommodate the rising power. There are actually a variety of different pathways that local powers that are weaker, that faces a rising power, there are a variety of different alternatives and options that they can pursue to deal with a rising power. And so I would argue that our presence essentially sort of denies that possibility of the smaller state bandwagoning essentially with the rising hegemon in Eurasia. As for the Chinese view, what's very interesting is that the Chinese, at least the Chinese that I read, have a very realist outlook on the world. They do not believe they can entrust their own economic well-being to the what they consider to be the fickle goodwill of the United States. Ideally for them, it would be great for the U.S. Navy essentially to underwrite and subsidize their access to the seas, right? That we essentially guarantee their energy security. But many Chinese strategists believe that as a responsible great power, as a rising power that has been great for many centuries in the past, China has to have its own capabilities to protect its own economic interests, which is a very realist argument, right? It's all about power, and China needs to acquire the power to protect its economic interests. Many of them don't buy the argument that sort of globalization, economic interdependence, and so on and so forth will essentially make competition moot. And they are especially deeply suspicious about American motives and American intentions. And I think one interesting anecdote, it's not really an anecdote, I've actually come across multiple Chinese writings when they read the 2007 Maritime Strategy. On the surface, that document is extraordinarily cooperative, talks about multilateralism. It really sets the stage for the so-called thousand-ship navies, where local powers will band together to essentially maintain good order at sea. But many Chinese strategists that I've read focused on that one paragraph in the document that was very assertive, that said that the United States will, in fact, assert local sea control wherever it needs to and unilaterally if it has to. And that's actually the passage that they focus on. They ignore all of the cooperative stuff. They focus on what they believe to be the underlying driver behind the maritime strategy, which is the continuing pursuit of American dominance on the high seas. And so I think, again, the Chinese tend to have a very realist outlook. And I'm not saying all Chinese, but there is a very vocal school of thought and a very influential one that tends to adopt of a very cold-blooded view of international systems.
Yeah, it's in a sense. You mentioned looking back to look ahead, and some of the dynamics are similar to what the United States underwent during the 19th century. Tushy was referring to the phenomenon that IR types, international relations types, and economists call free riding. The notion that smaller powers, weaker powers, can rely on bigger powers to provide security and other public goods for them. You could argue, and we have argued, that the United States did this for most of the 19th century as it started rising to great power. The United States declared the Monroe Doctrine in the 1820s, but it had no military wherewithal to enforce such a doctrine. Yet, because the Royal Navy remained the world's dominant fleet, and because Great Britain had interests of its own in keeping other Europeans out of the New World, the United States, in effect, was able to free ride on the Royal Navy until it became a strong nation in the 1880s, and especially in the 1890s and beyond. So you saw the United States content itself with free riding for most of the century, but then as it became strong and had the wherewithal to start tending to its own maritime security, especially after starting to build the Great White Fleet, the U.S. started to usher Great Britain out of the Western Hemisphere, which, of course, happened after the turn of the century.
It was really interesting to hear your discussions on China, because it's really hard to argue with, especially from the Chinese perspective, a lot of that scholarship on our strategy. Makes pretty good much sense to me. A few questions ago, we kind of brought it up and then went on another concept. I want to come back to it for a little bit. Is there a connection between the concept of offshore balancing and the ongoing discussion about the air-sea battle concept in the last few years?
Jim, you want to take that?
Yeah. Well, I think it seems like a natural fit. I don't know of anybody who is sort of doing one thing and doing the other. But it seems like it seems like you have to have. If you're going to do offshore balancing, you by definition have to be able to do some sort of air-sea battle doctrine in order to get access to those rim lands, to the Indian Ocean, to East Asia or Western Europe or wherever the contingency might be. But one of our big critiques of the offshore balancers is simply that they don't get into details about what they mean, about how they would make offshore balancing work. They simply don't say what they mean by it. They tend to be rather slippery, and if you press them for details, they can be very evasive about the details. So I guess the answer is that it's a natural fit. If we're actually going to be an offshore balancing nation, then we're going to have to come to grips with gaining access to those regions. Especially that's difficult in the Indian Ocean, simply because if you look at the map, where does the United States gain access to the Indian Ocean? Well, if China's the power being balanced against, is it going to permit U.S. forces to pass through the South China Sea en route to the region, or is it going to contest access there and cause losses before we even get into the theater? So there's a range of questions that we really have to take on if we're going to go to this mode of grand strategy. And that's the main point of our article, I guess, is that we need to think about the details before we buy this concept.
Right, and I would add that one sort of key component of air-sea battle is that we would be able to sequentially win back command of the commons across the Western Pacific if we were in a high-end contingency against China. But I think to sequentially win back command of the commons would require us to actually win back access to major operating bases forward, and that would primarily reside across the Japanese home islands. And in our view, and we argue this in the article, is that the main risk with offshore balancing is that if we shutter some of the bases and if we come home, many of those bases may become unavailable to us. They could be converted into commercial ports, like we saw at Long Beach. It could be converted for local military purposes, or local allies could basically say, no, you won't have access to these bases. You know, you basically cut and run. Why should we make these bases available to you? And so here we have a sort of a major stumbling block where if we were to adopt the offshore balancing strategy of pulling back, our absence of access to those forward operating bases would really undermine a key component of air sea battle. And I think if you read the CSBA, the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Analysis version of the air sea battle, you know, there's a very interesting footnote in the report where it says, you know, access to bases in Japan is absolutely critical to this, and if the Japanese were ever to refuse access in a high-end contingency, those guys are on their own, right? I mean, it's a very, very sort of stark warning to the Japanese, but also it really underscores the importance of those forward bases. And so, again, it offshore balancing assumes that if we leave some of those places, that those places would remain available. But I think we cast some doubt for a variety of reasons whether those bases would, first of all, be available, and if they are, that they would be in any shape for us to gain access and to win back command of the commons across the Western Pacific.
Yeah, but let me reemphasize something that Toshi said, but we spent a fair amount of time talking about the alliance building aspects of this. Toshi said it. Toshi used the term cut and run. Not only would the United States have once cut and run by severing its shutting its bases, severing its partnerships with these nations, and so forth, but if it sticks to the concept of offshore balancing, it would be advertising that it plans to cut and run again as soon as it gets the opportunity, simply because it's bent on cost savings, and it's, I think, openly advertising that you're an unreliable partner and intend to remain so in the future is not a great approach to alliance building. So that's something that we get into in a fair amount of detail in the article as well.
And you know, folks just have to drive through Long Beach today to see what happened to critical naval facilities, when they're turned over for civilian uses. Many facilities become virtually unusable and cannot be reconverted for military use without extraordinary expense. And so, you know, it would be highly risky, essentially, to turn things over and assume that those assets will remain in place in the way that we need them in times of crisis or conflict.
Yeah, we point out with the offshore balancers. I think Christopher Lane probably gives the most credence to the notion that we need to continue a regular schedule of exercises with our partners and maintaining ties overseas. But that being said, it amounts to one almost a throwaway paragraph in an entire book that he published about offshore balancing. So it very much feels like an afterthought. These folks are simply overlooking. Impediments of enormous magnitude when they talk about this stuff.
Well, speaking of impediments of enormous magnitude, as an old Mobile Logistics Service Force guy from the Vietnam era, I was really interested in your section of your piece on how we would have to configure our force to meet what I guess is the worst case contingency that we would face. And you were talking, I believe, about the doubling of the number of SSNs we have and a whole slew of things, including a substantial increase in our combat logistics force. Could you discuss that a little bit, please?
You want me to start, Toshi?
Sure.
Yeah, we actually criticized one of our heroes, Samuel Huntington, the late Samuel Huntington, for his article in 1954 in Proceedings, where he essentially described the Navy as a baseless force, meaning a force that can operate without forward bases. We think he's fed into this notion that naval forces are completely independent of support from forward bases as well as bases here on American territory. So that's one thing. We basically, when we start talking about these force structure things, we point out that if China or if an aspiring hegemon wants to contest U.S. access to the theater, it's an easy way for it to do so would be to simply try to pick off CLF combat logistics units transiting to and from the forward areas where the fleet's operating. So what we're basically saying in there is that we're going to need to anticipate the likelihood of losses getting into the region as well as operating there. And this lends us to think that we're going to need not only oilers and ammunition ships and whatnot, but also tenders, something that we've let pretty much go entirely in recent years. We need the capabilities to essentially make up for the loss of bases, to all the things that Toshi was talking about, bases being reconverted for civilian use. They're no longer suitable to support the fleet, and so forth. So we spent a fair amount of time getting into that. It does seem like the sort of non-sexy elements of the fleet are the ones that we might need the most of.
Right, and I think, you know, part of our critique in doing this force sizing exercise and looking at some of the requirements. Now, people can quibble about, you know, what exactly we need and how much exactly we need, but the reason we did it was that we were trying to prod the offshore balancers to get into specifics about what would be required to have an offshore balancing fleet. And I think our critique and, you know, our main point is that, You know, if you wanted to do offshore balancing, I think the assumption is that you can sort of snap your fingers and a naval force would appear, and then that would be available for us to surge forward and defeat whatever the rising hegemon might be. And, you know, our point is that, no, that's not true. You know, it would require sustained investments in the kinds of expeditionary capabilities that would take years, if not decades, to fully develop in the absence of forward bases. And so we were really sort of trying to get into specifics to show that, you know, having the forces to do what offshore balancers think would be required is something that is neither cheap nor easy. I would also say that because we're talking about a scenario in which a very powerful regional hegemon challenges the global balance of power, so we're talking about, you know, at least a decade, if not several decades, out from today, we can envision essentially an environment in which we would have not just an anti-access area denial environment, but a hyper-anti-access, hyper-area denial capabilities by our adversaries, meaning that parts of the Western Pacific would be that much more difficult to get into. And so things like the DF-21D, the anti-ship ballistic missile, we would imagine that perhaps the Chinese will have many more than they have now, maybe more capable, more accurate, maybe longer range, and that they would have them available to not only target things like our carrier, which is the sort of the thing that we always think about, but it can be used to target against our Aegis. It can be used to target against our fleet replenishment capabilities. And so that means that redundancy becomes a premium in this offshore balancing world. And I think that's why we kind of bumped up those numbers in anticipation of the kinds of capabilities that regional adversaries might possess a decade or two or three from now.
When you, Toshi, when you look at a map of the Indian Ocean, and, you know, a lot of people, you know, we're talking about China's sea lines of communications, and obviously named after the subcontinent, you have the world's largest democracy whose population will soon surpass that of China, India, and their very angry sister Pakistan next to her. But over in the bottom right-hand corner, there's a whole continent called Australia. And I know a lot of the national security news last few months about Australia is the fact that our Marines are setting up off in Darwin. And a lot of the discussion when it comes to Australia usually involves East Asia concerns. Now, how does Australia play in the Indian Ocean and it really any type of strategic concept that we would adopt in the long term towards that area?
Right. You know, I think it's important to note that Australia and Australians consider themselves not just a purely Western Pacific power, but that they do consider themselves part of the Indian Ocean community, the Indian Ocean strategic or security community. You know, its entire western coast faces the Indian Ocean, and in fact, Perth, a major naval base, is essentially an Indian Ocean-facing base. And in fact, it is a facility that the Australians have already begun to think about opening up access to our carriers and to our submarines, et cetera. So I think Australia could potentially play a very important role in the future as the center of gravity shifts from the Western Pacific to an Indo-Pacific region, because Australia is sort of geographically positioned to be a pivot state. And so having access to those bases on the West Coast gives the Australians and give us flexibility to essentially anticipate and manage the rise of China and India and as they march to the seas. And certainly having having access to Australia means that we would have both the support and the capacity, essentially, to essentially monitor future Chinese naval activities in the Indian Ocean. There's been some talk about having some presence on the Cocos Islands with UAVs and other aerial platforms that would enable us to have a more robust surveillance capacity. And certainly that gives us an additional option to monitor future Chinese naval movements in the Indian Ocean. And again, it underscores the growing strategic importance of Australia, both not only in terms of its position, but both in terms of its growing willingness to accept and tolerate greater U.S. presence there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you referred to the map. If you look at the map, it seems logical to start working with the Australians to try to position forces. We did a victory lap, I think, when we heard about the Marines moving to Darwin, and I hope that more robust arrangements will be in the works in the coming months and years. But certainly, if you're going to think in terms of the Indian Ocean and the Pacific, the Western Pacific in particular, as one undivided expanse, it only makes sense to have a central location from which the fleet can swing from east to west or vice versa as conditions warrant. And Australia sits right at the seam between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific components of that grand region that the maritime strategy directs us to focus our gaze on. So I'm glad what we've done, and I hope that we will do more with this in the future.
And I think there's one critical Chinese capability and development that will potentially increase the growing importance of Australia. In a conference that we attended a couple of years ago, we had a retired admiral from India who basically said that, you know, we don't mind if the Chinese deploy their carriers into the Indian Ocean because, you know, that might be a capability for maintaining good order at sea to defend the sea lines of communications. But there is one red line that the Indians would not tolerate, and that is the presence of Chinese nuclear attack submarines. The presence of Chinese SSNs would be a major crossing of a red line, would be a major triggering point that would really cause the Indians to seek to counteract that presence. And so, again, having Australia as a platform from which we can essentially monitor and keep track of future Chinese capabilities like their nuclear attack submarine really gives us an additional option in anticipation of future developments.
Jim, you had an article last year, almost a year ago, on offshore balancing in Taiwan. Could you discuss that a little bit?
I think you're probably referring to a short piece I put in the Taiwan or in the Taipei Times over in Taiwan. I'm always trying to caution the Taiwanese, and Toshi and I, in fact, have written a fair amount about Taiwanese naval strategy. I was basically issuing a warning that if the United States goes down the offshore balancing route, that paints a pretty grim picture for the Taiwanese insofar as they need to look to their own devices for their own defense, which I think is absolutely critical if Taiwan wants to preserve its status as a de facto independent power. So essentially, I was just looking at the implications of what the offshore balancers say. Offshore balancing logic would see support of Taiwan as a clear loser, in which case Taiwan has to look to its own defenses or else run the risk of losing its independence. So you want to chime in there? You weren't in on that one, but you've certainly been on everything else.
Well, I mean, I would, I'm just thinking in terms of from a realist perspective. I think if you're a realist and you care only really, you know, the only thing that matters in the international system are great power interactions. I think if you are a realist that's true to realist principles, you would argue essentially that Taiwan is essentially an impediment to proper great power relations between the United States and China. And so if you're a realist, I think you would naturally make arguments that would seek to write Taiwan off as a strategic liability and get on with a quote-unquote healthier great power relationship with China. So in that sense, offshore balancing probably would fit to the extent that Taiwan should not and would not be a major issue with which to fight over with China.
Yeah, I don't want to get into the discussion about the Israel lobby, but it is worth noting that that a couple of the key offshore balancing scholars, very, you know, pretty high profile guys like John Mearsheimer and Steve Walt up at the Kennedy School at Harvard, they see Israel in much the same terms. It's if you're entirely concerned about great power relations, standing up for these small nations that find themselves in difficult spots is a loser for a U.S. offshore balancer.
Can I follow up on that? Let me. Where do we draw the line? I mean, if the Philippines, is it all the weak nations you just kind of throw them to the wind? I mean, if you adopted the most extreme version of OSB, how do you deal with people that have been long term allies? The Philippines, some of those countries out there that don't have much of military and they haven't had to have one. I mean, theoretically, they would grow one if they needed to, under the extreme version of OSB, but if somebody said, well, tomorrow we decided that the Spratlys and the Scarborough Reef isn't enough, we really want Luzon. Do we just go, well, that's nice, take it, or how do you deal with that?
Well, yeah, I think that, this is one of those places where if you press these people, they get a little bit evasive about such details. But if you hold them to the logic of what they're pushing, they have to say yes. I mean, it's much the same with Taiwan or Israel or what have you. They are betting, and this is a very theoretical way of looking at the world, but they are betting that offshore balancing will impel these countries to provide for their own defense. To bandwagon with one another to counterbalance a rising hegemon, much as 19th century Europe, there were shifting alliances in Europe as one power started looking threatening. Nations would shift alliances and balance that power so to keep a balance in Europe. Worked pretty well for most of the 19th century, but obviously it breaks down in the 1870s with the rise of Germany. It's an accurate way of characterizing what they say. The Philippines needs to bandwagon with others to tend to its own defense.
Right.
Yeah.
We actually have a fairly concrete piece of evidence in terms of the consequences of offshore balancing with the Philippines. We withdrew our military forces in 1992. And then, of course, not so coincidentally, in 1995, the Chinese seized the Mischief Reef from the Philippines. And what we also find is that the Philippines has had a hard time engaging in self-help to counterbalance China. And now we are in the midst of this standoff where there's a standoff between the Chinese and the Filipinos over Scarborough Shoal. So, we have in that particular case an example of what happens when the United States creates a power vacuum by withdrawing, where that actually encourages creeping expansionism on the part of other regional powers.
Yeah, and the offshore balancers would probably predict that if the U.S. does this, ultimately ASEAN becomes a serious counterweight to China. So there's a lot of back and forth that you can get into on such matters. But yeah, I think Toshi said it exactly right.
You talk about Brave New World. I would love to see an ASEAN meeting in Hanoi. That would mean we have truly reached the new century here. But, it's not too far of a reach. I know we're over, but I want to take advantage of Toshi, you and Jim's hospitality, because there's a question I really wanted to get in, and I know the people live aren't going to catch it, but most of our listeners get the archive anyway, so that's all right. Robert Kaplan, he talked about the greater Indian Ocean. And as I was thinking about that and expanding on it, I also, in the last year or so, not really longer than a year, but when people talk about resource competition and areas of friction points in the maritime environs, there's been discussions mostly of the Arctic, and of course, we just touched on a little bit the South China Sea, on where there's some economic and resource potential areas of conflict. Hopefully it'll just be a job of the diplomat and the lawyers. But when you look at Kaplan's concept of the greater Indian Ocean, where are its friction points, in particular in its possible bleeding edge?